Hi, welcome to the Purposefully Human Radio Hour, where we have conversations about creating a more human world. I'm Neil Woodson, and with me is my co-host, Jerry Seifert, and we are so happy that you're joining us today. Before we get to our guest, Jerry, what's going on out there in the world of Seattle?
We're having a little touch of spring. We're kind of in an in-between season, but looking forward to great things. I did want to share, Neil, that I started a new practice that I'm having a lot of fun with. I'm trying to teach myself a habit of whenever I enter a room of sharing some kind of human gift with someone in that room. It might be as simple as eye contact and a smile, or if somebody's struggling with their packages or whatever, it's an offer of help. And I'm trying to make this pretty much part of my DNA. I've often done a lot of this in the past, but what I realized the other day is, the need for connection is greater than ever. And I wasn't rigorous about it. I wasn't,
Yeah.
it wasn't a habit. So I'm 3 days in, and I've done it all 3 days. So I'm hoping that this is going to stick. I'm really excited about
Trying to be a more human.
it. Exactly. Because we have to, mind those P's and Q's, right? If
Sure.
we're hoping to, fulfill our commitment in purposefully human.
Well, I know I usually bring a story that's like on the up, on the positive, but I don't have one. I have one actually of a good example. I just thought this was a great example. I also think it leads into our guest a little bit. And it's a story I heard yesterday. I was talking to a gentleman who told me about he was in a parking lot, a pay parking lot, and he was sent a barcode by the company, the people that run the parking lot. And he was sent this barcode on his phone. And to pay, you had to go up and scan the barcode and then you could pay. He went up and he scanned the barcode and it wouldn't scan. And he did everything he could think of, move it farther away, move it closer, hold it up differently. He tried it like 10 different ways and nothing worked. And he was, and there were no humans to help. There wasn't a phone number. There was nothing. There was nothing he could do. It was completely stuck. And so he had no alternative but just to leave without paying. And he said, "I feel horrible. I feel like a criminal." And and we're talking maybe 20 bucks or something. It's not like he, scammed the national bank or anything, but I think it was a great example of what dismissing people and their needs can do to those people, right? And I think that leads us right to the work of our guest today. But before
Just one quick thought on that. As we're talking to our guest, and to build on that story, it really does illustrate something that we talk about a lot, which is the power of legacy paradigms. Parking structures have been a great way for investors to make a lot of money on real estate for a very long time. So, in order to make ever more money, they have to make it more automated, which means guess what happens to your friend when he has the need for help? There's no one there. Yeah. So, and we don't question it, and it makes us, I believe, less human in the process. So on to our guest.
Well, but before we meet our guest, I need to mention something. This program comes to you from the Purposefully Human Community, which is a group committed to giving people a voice in creating a more human world with more humane organizations. You can find out more at purposefullyhuman.com or on LinkedIn by searching for Purposefully Human. So now we can talk about our guest. Today we have with us Asha Sarod. Asha is the founder of Uniquity Consulting and a lawyer by training. Her work focuses on human-centered leadership and how, by recognizing and appreciating people's uniqueness and fullness, leaders can not only see higher quality work and more productivity, but also make work more meaningful to the people doing it. Her end game, she says, is to help emerging leaders lead with identity by equipping them with the skills and confidence to reduce turnover, increase engagement, and inspire teams through genuine human connection. I don't think there's any better link to the message and the work of the Purposefully Human community. Asha, my dear friend, welcome to the Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Good to see you again, Jerry.
Great to see you, Asha. I've been away for a little bit, and I know you've been away for quite a while. You went to India recently.
Yes.
I just went to South Carolina, so not a big deal. But I want to ask you, so tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and what things are kind of sparking your mind and getting you going, and what are you doing these days?
I always like to take in information from all over the place. So I actually just watched a documentary on the Gilded Age, and it was interesting how it kind of talks about how the titans of industry kind of shaped our workforce, right? And how we kind of know work today. But yeah, my main focus, I mean, if we're talking about the work that I'm doing, is really getting people to connect with other human beings, understand their feelings, which is like kind of a dirty word at work, and understand the stories that come from those feelings. So, for example, we, talk about how someone might just be talking about how they're frustrated at work. That's a feeling. But if you dig in, you actually understand why, you start to understand the story behind that frustration. I'm working on this project. I don't know how to do X, Y, or Z. Now, all of a sudden, you're learning bits and pieces about that person, about their background, about who they are, about what their strengths are, their weaknesses are, just from asking about a feeling, asking them why, and listening to the story that follows. And so that's kind of the ethos of what I'm trying to get leaders to do, which is really simple, yet kind of really hard, because that's not what leaders have been told to do. They're told to get results at all costs. And so that human part tends to be missing, unfortunately.
So I think that we're going to get more deeply into that in a minute. But before we kind of go there, and I think this is a kind of a tags on to that, is I want to talk about being purposefully human for a minute, because this is the Purposefully Human Radio Hour. And I want to ask you, when I say purposefully human, what does that mean for you? What does that conjure up for you, and what does it make you think about?
Yeah, I think about what we do versus who we are. Each individual has their own unique identity in terms of the things that they value, the things that they care about, their interests, their belief systems. And when you are being purposefully human, you're pulling from that rather than the role that you play. Being whatever job you have, whatever roles you have as a parent, et cetera, and what kind of society tells you you're supposed to be doing, or what society tells you is important, rather than that kind of pulling from your own personal North Star and the things that matter to you. So acting on that, acting on that foundation, I think is the most core aspect of being purposefully human.
One of the things, this is interesting in so many different ways. But this morning I was reading, I get all these emails from all kinds of different things. And this morning I got one, and it had a quote by Simon Sinek, who he said that one of the hardest things for humans to do is to be human. And I've thought about your work, because I know a lot about your work, and this is full disclosure to anyone out there. Asha and I have worked together on some projects and things, and she's helped me hone my message in ways, and I've helped her hone her message in ways, and so we do kind of know what each other does. And I'm interested to know, why do you think it's so hard for us to be human with each other?
There's that piece of the societal aspect, right? Like the expectations that are put on us. And I also think there's this very clear divide that is very ingrained, especially in American philosophy, of there's work and then there's not work. And so you're supposed to kind of separate who you are in those two environments. So it's okay to be human in yourself outside of work, with your family, with your friends, etc. But once you're in work, you're supposed to embody this other being that is not who you genuinely are oftentimes. It's what expectations of what your company wants of you, what success is supposed to be like, what, makes the business profitable, etc., etc. And so we kind of lose that human piece. We don't get a chance to access it because we're explicitly told not to. I mean, that whole phrase, like, leave your personal life at home, right? I mean, you hear leaders say that all the time. So that piece, I feel like, is what we've kind of made this artificial separation between different parts of our lives, when in fact the same human is attending to their family as well as their workplace, right? And you don't lose that humanity and all of those, like I said, those needs, values, interests when you go to work. So.
Jerry, I know you've had a lot of different jobs. You've done different things all over the place, and I know you've worked with a lot of different kinds of people. And I know you've seen this over and over and over. Why do you think that is? I mean, I know I have. I know. Can't tell you how many times working for different companies and things, or that I heard the phrase, leave your emotions at the door. That kind of thing, which I thought was, I always think that's kind of hilarious, because it's not like humans can just do that, you know?
I hear so many stories. Thank you, Asha, because you went right to a place of particular concern for me. And you hear and you read and stories of people, single parents with adults that they take care of. They're active in their community. Maybe they do PTA. Maybe they volunteer. And then they get to work and they push a button all day. There's no acknowledgement of that full humanity. And you just added a historical perspective that had somehow eluded me. This goes all the way back to the industrialization of the country, and the need for, the capitalists to, get the most productivity out of the people in their factories. So of course, you're going to, if you're designing the work, if you're managing the work, if you're supervising, you're going to sort of slice and dice that person down to their muscles and bones. And if you take time to listen, you take time to appreciate the fullness of that person's humanity and what have you. The way that industrial capitalism was constructed, maybe you're going to get away with it. You'll probably get fired, but in the old industrial model. But somebody above you is also watching the scoreboard, and somebody above them is watching that person's scoreboard. And what have you. So ultimately, so Neil, to get to the question, ultimately, there's this, not only is there a separation, but there's a scorekeeping system that ensures that this mechanistic view of humanity is reinforced all the way to our current day. What do public corporations get rewarded for? Earnings
Do
and
you think,
stock price.
right?
do you think that there's any, I mean, and Asha, I know you, in our conversations, and you and I talk about this stuff all the time. Do you think there's fear in there for, I mean, managers are, because I'll put it this way. I think a lot of managers want to be more human. They want to make it more human, but they're afraid to, and they're afraid to kind of step out and say, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. Why are we treating people like machines? Why are we doing these things? And I know your work focuses specifically on trying to get managers to kind of do that to a degree. Maybe not to try to get fired, obviously, but to do work and to do things in their work and in their leadership that recognizes people's humanity. And one of the things you talk about very specifically is identity. And I'll never forget, we've only known each other for a couple of years, and I remember when we first met, you started talking about identity, and I said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, stop. What is that? What do you mean by that? What's that all about?" So could you kind of get us to what that means exactly, so we can have a little bit of dialogue around that?
Yeah, totally. Sorry, one thing that Jerry said that really kind of leads into this is the whole history. And Neil, you talked about it too in your books. I know how we went from this kind of manufacturing mindset of how work is supposed to operate. It's all about results, it's all about productivity.
Sure.
And now we've shifted into this knowledge worker mindset, right? So now who people are and the unique qualities they bring are going to be super important to how effective they are in the workplace. It isn't just, hit the hammer, complete the widget, do your job in the factory line, right? And so that's really essential nowadays. So this whole concept of identity is and I'll give you kind of my kind of boring definition, which is all the characteristics that a person contains and all of the values, experiences, interests, strengths, and weaknesses that flow from those experiences. So that's complicated. Let me give you an example. So let's take a characteristic like someone's financial status, for example, right? Different financial statuses are going to expose people to different experiences. What do I mean by that? Think about the education that someone gets if they have a high financial status versus a low financial status. So if you're wealthy, where are you going to school? Do you have access to AI, computers, right? Who are the individuals that you're talking to and the information that you're getting from them? Now, lower financial status, you might have access to different individuals. You may not have access to computers. You may not have access to AI. You still are getting information, but you might be using books. You might be using, different resources. You might be going to a community college. So different experiences, right? And I'm not putting a value judgment on either of those. It is just different and they're valuable in their own ways, right? Use that same characteristic, financial status. What experiences is that person having? Maybe the person who's got low financial status, they're going camping, they're going to baseball games, they're going to local events. Who are the people they're meeting? What are the foods they're eating? What are the environments that they're in? Higher financial status, maybe they're playing tennis, maybe they're going to charity events. Again, different atmospheres, different experiences, and they're learning skill sets with every single one of those experiences, right? The guy who's going camping knows how to light a fire, knows how to pitch a tent, right? Knows how to use a compass. Those are skill sets that can be valuable given the right situation. And so, what I'm trying to get at with this whole concept of identity is each of us has these varied characteristics about ourselves. And each of those has led to a number of different experiences and different strengths and weaknesses that we all bring to the table, in addition to the things that actually motivate us, right? Our value systems. And if we our value systems might be different based on the things that we were exposed to, and that's going to change what motivates us at work as well, right?
So in, and I know you've experienced this, and I know you have a great, in one of your workshops, you have a exercise that people have to go through when you talk about an Asian woman, and you give all these examples, and people they kind of apply stereotypes to it, and they do all kinds of things, and finally you say that person's me, and I think that's a great example. But can you give us an example of maybe your own experience or somebody else's experience where, when people's identity is ignored in the workplace, what happens to them? And then what happens when it's recognized and appreciated?
Yeah. I'll
What
give
kind of
you
shift takes place? And
Yeah.
tell us in give me your thumbnail of that.
So I just worked with a client recently, and she had two employees. And up until that point, she felt like there's kind of disconnect, right? She's like, I
Right.
can't like communicate with them the way I really want to. So I had her just start with that, using her one-on-ones to get to know the background of the people that she's working with, right? One of them, now what she had done with her role, since they were technically the same role, they had the same definition, she kind of split the work, right? So she said, okay, you do half of the cold calling, the other person does the other half of the cold calling, and then you have some other tasks that are kind of a little more particular to your skill set. One person did a newsletter, one person did some event planning, right? And by digging into these individuals' backgrounds, she found out that one person really loved the cold calling. And she was surprised herself because she was like, I thought everybody would hate cold calling, right? One person loved it. They wanted to build that skill set of cold calling, getting to know how to communicate in that awkward sort of situation. And
You
the
know,
other
right
person,
now, every manager in the every sales manager in the world that's listening to this is going to try to contact you to find out who that
I
person
know.
is. Because nobody likes to do a cold call. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So yeah, I mean, I had the same impression. I was like, wow, I never thought that was possible. But
Right.
it was because she had that conversation trying to understand this individual's background and the skill sets that she was trying to develop for herself that she discovered, hey, this person's actually great at cold calling. The other person did not like it, but really enjoyed writing. And so she started to give her more work on this newsletter, right? So it was only by exploring kind of their backgrounds, what they were interested in, that she found out that she was able to use these two skill sets and get the work done for the company. So it's not like the company work fell out the window, right? It's, hey, now I have someone who actually enjoys doing cold calling. And I even suggested, I'm not sure if this is going to happen yet, but I was like, hey, if you know one person enjoys doing it, is getting something from it, why not give it all to that person? Right? There's nothing wrong with that. Yes, they have the same role and the same title, but you are now giving each of those individuals something that they are uniquely motivated by based on who they are as individuals. And they're going to do a good job at it because they care about it, because it matters to them and where they want to go in their career.
So, question. I'm a manager and I'm out there and I've got, eight people that were, that are my direct reports. And how the hell am I supposed to have time to do that? How do I
Yeah,
do this? I mean,
it's a good question.
and that, because it's true,
Yep.
I mean, I've taught a lot of leadership classes myself and, I try to give you techniques and things that you can do to lead better. And everybody says, yeah, but I don't have time for that. What's your response to that?
It's a familiar refrain, and I built my like program on the idea that like you don't have to change what you're doing right now. Most teams have a one-on-one or a check-in, right? And those check-ins usually last for at least 30 minutes, sometimes an hour. What do most managers do with those check-ins? What are you working on? How can I help you? Right? They go straight to the work. It's the first thing they talk about. That is your opportunity to actually understand that individual better. And it doesn't have to be the whole meeting. Pick the first 10 minutes. You know, instead of, and actually the person I was just coaching, they just expanded. They did a little bit of that. Hey, how was your weekend? You know, everybody kind of does that. That's
The
okay.
chit chat,
Right.
right?
The chit chat. Right. But what I asked her to do is use those first 10 minutes of that meeting and go deep quick. And how do you do that? What I say is like ask about three feelings the person is having. And I know we said, you know, feelings are kind of a bad word at work. The reason I say feelings is because feelings are the one thing that we can all relate to. Right. I may not know exactly what this employee is going through, maybe with the project that they're working on, et cetera. But if they say, hey, I'm really confused, I know what it's like to be confused. Everybody's had that experience. And then when you ask why and dig in, you're going to get a story. They're going to tell you, I'm working on this project. I'm really confused with the numbers piece. I'm not a numbers person. I do really well with words, but the numbers are confusing me. You just got a story and now you learn something about that person, right? You can put it in your kind of knowledge piggy bank about that person. You may not use it right away, but maybe the next project comes around and you're like, ah, Tom
It's
doesn't really
also a
work that.
change. You know, what's interesting in that, and I've used a similar technique with people and talk about this, is that when you find out about something, I find out something about Asha. She's not comfortable with numbers. But Jerry's really comfortable with numbers. And here's a project where there's a talent of Asha's that she has that would work with Jerry. And this is a great opportunity for Jerry to help Asha learn about numbers.
Yes.
Right. And so
Yes.
you can begin to put
Put people
people
together.
together to fill in blanks that the other person
When
has.
do we start?
Yeah.
Although I
And
don't know that Jerry is good with
I'll
numbers.
help Asha.
But
But the one piece I do want to say is, I've been using a lot of like work, project related examples. It doesn't always have to be that. Like, you learning about that person's personal life can
Right.
also reveal a ton of valuable information about what motivates them, new skill sets that they have. Like the guy who's like the social media influencer in his spare time. This person knows how to record video. They know how to speak. They know how to, come up with new important ideas that might be catchy. Like, those are all skill sets that are super valuable in, like, say, a marketing space, right? But if you just look at it as like, oh, that's what they do in their non-work time, you just missed out on all of those
Yeah.
skills, right?
What's interesting though, I thought you were leading somewhere else. I'm gonna go there. Is that you were talking about this isn't just about work, but it's about, life. For example, as a parent, I have two children. Jerry, you have children, and Asha, I know you were a child.
I have a dog.
You do have a dog. We often do this similar thing with our children, that we do in the workplace, because we try to project onto the children the things that we want, not the things that they want, or even the things that they're good at,
Right.
and and what that does to people, and what it does to people, it usually shuts them down, right, in one way, shape, or form, or at least it puts them from being excellent to mediocre, right?
Right.
Because I don't want to provide my best if all you want from me is the most, right? But we do it with children. We do it with friends. We try to, I want to make you into what I want you to be instead of letting them be what they are.
Right.
I don't know.
You're reminding me of an example where I at one of my jobs, there was a one of the higher ups who said, I think you'd be great at product marketing. And they're like, you do this well, you do that well, this would be perfect for you. And he kept trying to push me down that road. And I understood what he was saying. And I was like, I appreciate that you can see these qualities about me, but it's not what I want to do. And that is oftentimes what I've seen leaders do too, right? They'll say, oh my God, you're so good at this. Can you do this thing? But they never stop to ask, like, is that what that person wants to do? Right. And like you said, same with children. Your child might be great at, playing baseball. And you're like, keep playing baseball. And they're like, but I don't want to play baseball. Right. It's not what I enjoy. I want to be a dancer. Right. And you're like,
Well, it's
no,
funny.
no. But you're good at baseball.
This
Right.
happened with my son. My son's great to do anything with a ball. If it's round, catch it, throw it, kick it, he's great with it, and I grew up, there was nothing but football, baseball, or basketball. That's all there was. But I live in Maryland, where numero uno is lacrosse. And everything else comes second to that. Football, baseball, and basketball, those are ancillary things. That's lacrosse. We
I
go
didn't
to the
know
church of lacrosse. Anyway, and
that.
he grew up here and he did so well, everything he did with the ball. And I thought, oh, well, get out a baseball glove. Let's start throwing the baseball in the backyard. And finally he said, Dad, I don't want to play baseball. I do not want to stand out in the outfield all day. I don't, that's just not me. I want to play something where I run all the time, where I can actively participate more in the game. And he got involved with lacrosse, and I was lost because I'd never played lacrosse. I didn't know the rules. I didn't know anything, But had I pursued that and said, "No, you should play baseball," which is what a lot of parents do,
Yeah.
what would that do to him?
Right. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, there's a part of me that went down that sort of a path as well, right? It was you do what you are supposed to do. What you start to use these external criteria to validate your life, right? So someone says I'm good at baseball. I'm an athlete. That's
I guess
what I
that's what I
do.
have to be.
Right.
Right.
Right. And same with me. Like, I was like, okay, I went to law school. I'm a lawyer now. That's who I am. And you start to adopt the identity, whether or not that actually fits who you are. Right. And so, having gone from lawyer to entrepreneur to working in tech, like, I've had to switch my identity a bunch of times.
Sure.
And so, you start to then figure out, like, what's the core? What is the core of who I am? And everybody has it. It's just I don't think that we're taught when we're, especially when we're young, to actually really understand what is that core of who we are. And then as you grow, it's constantly shifting and changing, but there's some central set of values or things that you care about, interests that you have that usually carry through. They might shift and change a bit, but they're there, they stick with you. And as you have more experiences, you know, they kind of morph. But knowing what those are, I think, is the piece that a lot of people don't have access to.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's key to kind of having a successful life, but it's also key to having good relationships with the people that you're working with or in your personal life. I mean, understanding that aspect of that core of someone is huge.
Jerry, I know you got a comment.
I
I'm trying to
do. I
keep
do
up. I'm
'cause,
wedging. I'm going to wedge you in here because Ash and I could sit here and chat for a long time.
yeah, because you just helped me with a connection. Business has taken so much away from employees over the last generation. Benefits, education, promotion opportunities, employment security, real wages. I mean, you could, there's a, I mean, the list goes on and on, right? So now, in the legacy model where you're like handing out work tickets, we're also reinforcing this notion that that person has no agency. They have, in your world, no identity other than the task I give them.
Right.
So rather than doing that, someone that is supervising a business can actually respect that agency and acknowledge it, and instead of handing out work tickets, they can do the listening that you're talking about, and now they can ask questions like, "What do you enjoy doing?
Right.
What floats your boat? What would if it's in our power to provide it, what would get you excited about your work?"
Yes.
And instead of the old, because the old workplace model is based, as you very nicely pointed out, on the factory model of work tickets. You came to work and your work ticket was to run this machine or what have you. We brought that into the knowledge economy, but we didn't change the basic transaction between the enterprise and the worker. We still hand out work tickets. And yet what you're helping us understand is that if you take the time to understand the human, and that's where the purposefully part of purposeful human comes from, you have to be intentional about. You can find out all these wonderful things about them, these skills that they have, these interests, these what's at the core of their identity that is such that if I can accommodate that and match that to things that we need. Neil knows this, but lately I've been in Purposefully Human. Instead of asking people to do something that we've identified needs to be done, I've started to ask people, what do you like to do? And out of that, well, out of that came this program. And with another colleague, they're now writing Substacks about being purposefully human. And there are other examples of that, but that was the journey I took was, to quit doing the work breakdown structure, hand out work tickets, and I wonder why people are not happy about it. To, oh yeah, I love to write. I can pound out 2 pages of high quality non-chat GPT text a week, in my sleep. Cool. Why don't you write? We need writers.
But so I'll ask either one of you to respond to. I'm a manager and I hired Joe to do this. And we're a business, and I have ABC that has to be done. Turns out Joe doesn't like to do ABC. Now, what does Joe do? Does Joe leave, find greener pastures? Or, like Jerry says, do we say, well, what do you like to do? Well, I like to do C and D. You can see the problem here. How do we, but yet Joe's really talented guy. I mean, he's got a lot of skills and he can, I just see a bright future for this person. What do we do? What does the manager do? Jerry, I mean, what are your
So
thoughts?
this part, I can hear the manager being like, yeah, but we gotta get work done. I can't
We
just
got a
make
real
everyone
world
happy.
here.
Yeah. I can't make everyone happy and let them do what they want to do. And like you said, you hired them for a role. There's a few pieces to this. One is there are, just like the manager example I gave you, those two individuals had the same role, right? Technically, I mean, you look at the HR description, they're doing the same thing. But how you craft that role can be different, right? So if you know one person, like look at the kind of corpus of the tasks you have to complete, right? I gotta get X amount of, I'll just use it for example, X amount of writing done, X amount of, graphs and charts about, some project done. And now you know, okay, these are the things I need to get accomplished. What are the skill sets I have available to me within the team that I have? That's what you first have to figure out, right? What do I have to accomplish? What are the skill sets available? And to the extent possible, try to fit them, slot them into the things that they genuinely care about. Now, you're not going to make everyone happy. But what I have seen in my own personal experience, and even what I've seen with the people that I've trained, is there is a natural desire for people to reciprocate. This is a psychological phenomenon, right? When your manager makes an accommodation for you and helps you out and lets you do something that matters to you, they naturally reciprocate, right? And sometimes it's not even work related. So I had an employee who she played the violin. And so she had a violin concert. And we were at a startup, we're at a tech startup, right? So of course it's always like work, work, work. But what I said to her was, okay, what do you need to make sure that this concert goes well? She's like, I need to leave a little bit early so I can practice. Okay. I said, no problem. You leave early. As long as we can get the work done, I don't care when you do it. You leave early so you can practice. Then a few weeks later, we had a push. We had to work the weekend and there were no complaints, right? She picked it up right away because she was like, yeah, you take care of me, I take care of you. And so there's that piece of reciprocation. And the last piece I will say is we have to know that people do not think work is their first priority, that there are so many people in the workforce that do not consider work their first priority. So the question is, you as a manager, how can you understand that and use that reality in a way that's compatible with their work? So if they care about time with their family, figure out a way to make that workplace and that work environment work so that they can spend time with their family. It's going to come back to you in spades if you actually make that accommodation to help what motivates that person. So
But we've unfortunately gotten to this place
a mobile.
where these big corporations basically want you to make work the most important thing. This is what matters. This is what matters. And I even see a lot, I've seen articles recently about, young people, you're out of school, you've gotten your big job, you're in it, you're making your 80 grand a year, whatever it is, and this is the chance to grab the opportunity, work 24 hours a day, 8 days a week, 90 days a month, and get it all, get it done. Work, 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 work. Because when you're 45, you'll be in my position and you'll be able to crack the whip and tell everybody that's when you can, get on your boat on the weekend.
It's a hazing ritual. That's what
Yeah,
I think of.
yeah. No,
I
that's
think it's
great. No, that's perfect. I love that. So what do we do? How do we begin to change organizations? What do we do? I know what I say. When somebody asks me that, the first thing I say is you don't, it's not a revolution, it's an evolution. It's about one person at a time, one manager at a time, sticking in and saying, I'm going to do it a little bit differently. And
Yes.
slowly they evolve their unit, their team to be something
Right.
different,
That
without shaking things up too much, just enough to where it does make change and things are better. And somebody above them walks in the office and goes, it's different here. What's
yeah.
going on? So,
Go ahead, Jerry.
real quick. So we have a saying in Purposefully Human. How do you share the message of Purposefully Human? Well, you do it in a purposefully human way, which is one human to the next. So that's part of the answer. The other answer is, to your point, Neil, there is an element of crossing the Rubicon in the heart and soul of business leaders. I mean, so you just said, well, you do it, one unit at a time. Well, that leader has got to get to that precipice and jump over and be willing to take that risk. And that's part of, yeah, that's a big challenge for people right now because of all the pressures. And to your point about fear, I should have mentioned this earlier, but we have to remember that middle management has been clobbered over the last two generations already. So you don't have to look very far for someone in middle management to have some sort of a horror story of their own, or one about their colleagues about how they got short sheeted and badly treated and what have you. And if you're of a certain age, maybe mid-40s and above, you realize that there aren't even half as many of you as there were when you started working. So, yeah, so fear is constant. So I'd love to get Asha's thoughts on this because somewhere in there is a crossing the Rubicon moment for the individual. And sure, once you have a groundswell, Neil, to your point about starting with one team or what have you, you get two or three teams in an organization that are getting outstanding results, like some more foresighted companies in the world are getting. It will quickly spread because the results will be profound. So, Asha, any thoughts about the Rubicon, crossing the Rubicon moment, and how do you help Neil's mythical manager to take up, the tools of humanity and go forward and take the risk?
So I do agree. I think it is at the manager level because we talk about top down, and I know HR is like, it's got to be top down. And I think there's truth to that. Sure. If the top changes,
If you're
the,
lucky,
yeah, if you're lucky, if the
if you're
top
lucky,
changes, then sure, the, obviously it will trickle down. But in the absence of that, which unfortunately I think seems to be our reality, is that the top is inundated with board requests, quarterly earnings. They, unless they already have the skill set, they are not putting that time and effort
And don't
into.
forget, they've been indoctrinated into believing
Sure.
that that is exactly what they have to. This is
Yeah, that's what they're there for. Yeah.
what they were. I'm here for. I may have been the, you know, the I may have been the greatest, most human person when I was a middle manager, but now I'm in a senior vice president role or
Time
whatever it is, and my
for
sole purpose is
that
to sit in the boardroom and say yes to,
Right? Yeah.
making more money and more and more and more and more and more, right? So.
So that's why I agree with you that I think that the manager level is the best level, and it's not just because you can't affect the it's harder to affect the top, but like the statistics say so. So managers, I mean, you look at Gallup, 70% of the impact on employee engagement comes from managers. So they are the best poised to impact employees' engagement. And if you, the way I look at it is every manager's like an umbrella for their team. We all have been at companies where you're like, One team is just flourishing and the other team is like, what happened? They're losing people left and right. That is because there is good leadership in one place and not necessarily in the other, but they're all part of the same company, right? So it's not, we want to say it's like a one company culture, but frankly, there's cultures within every department, within every team. And so the way I look at it is make that manager, the one who acts as the umbrella for their team. And Jerry, to your point, this idea, this fear, I actually think it might be easier than we think because a lot of people are put into management roles without any direction. They're not told how to do it. So they actually have a lot of freedom to figure out how they want to create the structures and the support for their team.
But they
So
need, well, they need some sort of, for lack of a better term, some sort of, prophet to come in and talk to them about that, because typically managers lead the way they've been led, or they manage the way they've been managed. So, and that's part of the problem, is because we've, again, if we'll circle back to what we started with the Gilded Age, management was, control and, command and control, right? That's what management was. You manage people like a machine, you do the job. And there was so many workers during the Gilded Age, you could toss somebody out and bring somebody else in, because all they had to do was learn how to do one little thing. You do this one little thing, just do that, and you're going to do it every day for the rest of your life, and we still, in many ways, try to manage people that way instead of leading them, which is, I think there's a big difference in management leadership. And we think we can manage people, which is very difficult, almost impossible to do. And what we need is leaders. Well, people don't aren't taught to lead; they're told to manage. And so there has to be some enlightenment there. But if they can be enlightened, and if they decide, you know what? I saw a talk by Asha Sarod, and she was fantastic. And I'm come back, and I'm all fired up. And now, I want to do it differently. And I do think that that's possible. And you can do it without, flipping the boat over. You don't have to be Jesus and flip over the tables in the temple. You can do this in a way that is subtle, but it makes change.
It makes change for the people on your team who
On
then,
your
like you
team, right.
said, they then become the next set of managers and they
They become
learn.
the prophet for the next guy, for the next, the next wave. So I'm
So,
gonna, we're about to the end here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jerry, real
oh, just
quick.
real quick, I want to, because I just wanted to pin something to think about. I wonder if our new managers are points of leverage in this conversation, since they are not yet set in their ways, but also new man as managers, new managers, folks that are 30, 35, or even younger, they come out of an age cohort that's more likely to be sympathetic to this kind of conversation. They haven't been, they're not, old and grizzled and what have you, right, and beaten up in the workplace. They went through the hazing and they just thought that that was the way you did it, because they were told that's the way you did it, and we expect you to do it in your time as well. So just thought I'd pin that. Maybe our young first-time managers are a point of leverage for us.
Okay, so I'm going to
100%.
ask you the big final a final question. Probably pretty simple for you. You may have already answered it, but I just want to see if if you say something different. I want you to give, what is one simple takeaway that someone could leave this with from the Asha Sarod playbook, that they could actually do to be more purposefully human, or maybe in your kind of world, in your thinking, what's something they could do as soon as they turn off this podcast and go out in the world to begin leading with identity, as you like to say?
So I did say this before, but I'll say it again. So I think the best thing you can do is to ask, literally ask someone, tell me three feelings that you're having right now. And I say three because if you ask someone how you're feeling, they'll say, I'm good, right? If you
Mm-hmm.
ask for three, you're going to get something substantial. And then dig into those feelings, ask them why, and you will get a story. And from that story, you're going to learn a ton about that person's identity. It's pretty simple.
It is, and that's something anybody can do.
Yes,
You can
it
do it
works
again. I'm
anyway.
going to go back to the parenting. You can do it with your kids.
Yes, anyone. This is, in fact, when I've done trainings, a lot of times people come back and say, oh, I use that with my wife. I use that with my husband.
Yeah, I've done the same thing, you know. In fact, I taught a conflict management class once where a guy at the end of the class, he said, "What's something I can do?" Like it was a 2-day thing. And I said, "Well, go home, pick a fight with your wife, and use these techniques to make it go well." No, but yeah, that's a great tool for people to use. Ask for three feelings, and then get to something that's substantial in that, and then ask them why, and you'll get a story. I love that. That's perfect.
Without having the benefit of Asha's expertise, I accidentally did that the other day at the grocery store, because at the self-checkout, they always have a supervisor anyway, even though it's self-checkout. And this individual happened to mention that she has to be up by 2 o'clock every morning because she has to do X, Y, and Z, and then she opens the store at 5. And so well, how do you feel about having to be here every morning at 5 o'clock? And 15 minutes later, I had to politely extract myself from the conversation, as fascinating as it was, because she took that, to your point, Asha, she took that as her cue. Well, here's somebody that's asking a question that I care about. I do have feelings about it. Some of them were the ones you might expect. Others were a surprise, to be honest. It's not bad being here when it's quiet, so yeah, I can vouch for that, even though it was accidental, but I can vouch for that technique working. So maybe we should have started this recording with that, Neil. We can incorporate that in for future guests. I like that
I'll just put it
technique.
at the beginning. I'll just move it.
Yeah, I like that technique. That's there are three
Well,
things
Asha,
you
thank you so much. This is really all the time we have. I know we could probably talk longer. You and I usually do, just
do.
for no good reason. But I really want to thank you for taking the time to be
Yeah.
with us.
Thanks for having me. This was a great discussion. I enjoyed it.
Good to catch up, and appreciate you being willing to do this. This is important work, as I know you know from what you do. This is a great contribution to what we're doing. So thanks so much.
Thank you. It
Thanks,
was
Sasha. See
okay.
you. I'm sure I'll talk to you probably next week. So
Okay. Sounds
thanks a
great.
lot. Talk to you
All right.
soon. See ya. So, Jerry, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. What are three things you're feeling right now? Was a great technique. That was worth the price of admission right there.
Yeah, I like the kind of five whys kind of
Yeah.
nature. Ask three things, because the first one will be, oh, I'm doing okay. And then it'll be, well, I'm feeling kind of rough. Oh, well, I'm really depressed. Okay. The third one kind of gets you to something that's more substantial, you know?
Well, not only that, but I always struggle with techniques like the five whys, because I think they're more suited to either deeper conversations or workshops or places where people have an opportunity to prepare their answer. Whereas Asha is giving a, she gave us a tool that you can engage anybody with. Because feelings are that aspect of our identity that are right at the surface. And people know how they feel. You can get a psychotherapist in here to say, but is that really how they feel? And I get that. I mean, I'm not saying it's the end of the discussion, but what a great way to start a discussion. You know, what are three things you're feeling, and then use that as an opportunity to, you know, mutually get to know each other.
But I think, you know, what Asha was getting at was it's a great tool that can be used over and over and over to throw little coins in that piggy bank. I love that, you know, the little piggy bank of kind of knowledge about that person. So you're creating this kind of, I know this is going to sound bad, but like a dossier on that person. So you know, you're starting to learn about them. This is the kind of thing that makes them feel bad. This is the kind of thing that makes them feel good. This is the kind of thing that gets them fired up. This is, you know, you start to learn about people, and then that enables you to take that and say, Jerry really is into this. And I know I hired him to do this, but he still needs to do some of that stuff. But I want to start ushering him into things that utilize that thing that really gets him going. So
And
that
I
he's not
know
just
if
always doing the drudgery stuff.
we could have talked to Asha all day, but because I know she would agree with this, or I pretty much believe that she would. You have to be careful when you put things in that piggy bank to honor them. Because what a lot of people do, you know, some managers have learned this technique already. And instead of honoring the things in the piggy bank, and for example, you share something with me, but before I act on it, I come back to you and I say, do you mind if I share with my colleagues that you like to write? That then you're, you know, it's safe. What I see instead is a lot of people, they have a conversation like this. So this is a caution for our listeners about this, you know, idea of asking about three feelings. You have to honor what they tell you, because if as I've seen a lot of managers do, you pick up this thing, you put it in your piggy bank, and then you take your piggy bank to your next management meeting and you say, I have somebody that loves to write. I'm going to throw their name in the hat for that project. And then all of a sudden they're getting a phone call or an email from someone they've never met. Hey, you've been assigned to the thus and so project as a writer. You know, and they come into your office and you know, you go, oh, I guess that was me. I guess I'm responsible for that. But it's too late at that point, and the trust is broken.
And that's the key. That's like one of the key things. You got to have trust. If you don't have trust, I mean, I'm working on something right now with some people, and one of the things I keep bringing up is that humans rely on trust. We absolutely rely on trust. We, from our earliest beginnings, we have always relied on trust, and we even have natural mechanisms that we've built into our psyche for building and maintaining trust because we're social animals and we do things together. You know, and it's really unfortunate that we even have to have these conversations, because you would think, you know, we're social animals. Why should we have to be talking to people about being social animals? But throughout eons, we've been trying to separate us more and more and more, you
Yeah,
know? And,
that's that whole concept of the power of the legacy paradigm. Because we all know leaders and organizations that, you know, they end up using these little things in the piggy bank as weapons. Let's make sure we make that announcement at 5 minutes of five on Friday, because half of our people have after school pickup obligations, and they won't be able to, you know, there won't be a big reaction out on the call center floor like there might be on a Thursday. And it's like, whoa, you just like blew any chance you have of people having empathy for you or your situation or the difficulty of the announcement. Because everyone goes, well, why did they announce that at 5 minutes of five? Right. Well, guess what?
On
There's
the
no
day
one
before
here.
Christmas. On the day before Christmas, right?
Oh yeah, well, that's another good one. Not good one. I mean, how many people, probably everybody I know has a story. Thank you for adding that one, about getting, maybe not them, but their company issuing layoff notices on the last workday before a holiday period. Like, honestly.
Thank you. Well, Jerry, we could go on and on. We have reached about a minute left in the radio hour. Do you have any final words of wisdom for us? My only one would be, don't think you don't have to eat the entire elephant. And eat a little bit of the elephant. You can one it's one bite at a time. You don't go out there and think I'm going to shake up my entire organization. It's one step at a time with one person at a time, but we can make change if we're willing to change our behavior. So that would be my only word.
Well, and maybe mine, we touched on this when we were talking to Asha quite a bit, but just to take us out, I think on an individual level, the way this comes to life in the mind and soul of a manager, it is that there is somewhat of a crossing the Rubicon opportunity for folks. Maybe you don't have to change the world or even your company, but you have to change you. And because what she's talking about, which I is just profoundly insightful, is changing the way that you facilitate that conversation in your one-on-ones with your team. You have to be deliberate about not making it just about tasks. Because that's sort of the baseline, right? Hey, it's time for our one-on-one. I need to hear about your three projects. Oh, and oh, by the way, I might share some news from headquarters or what have you. Okay, we're done. Well, you're not done. I mean, if you're going to be this type of manager, you need to deliberately carve out that 10 minutes to do the things Asha suggested. And that is a little bit of a crossing the Rubicon moment, and it's a habit. It's like I said in the beginning, this little practice I'm trying to teach myself of entering a room and sharing a human gift with someone there. It has to become a habit in order for it to become the practice in the organization. And the companion insight was, well, maybe for future discussion, maybe we need to have a 30-year-old manager on one of our programs, but the idea that young first-time managers might be a point of leverage for Purposefully Human. Get the message to folks before they've gotten set in their ways. And then that helps them. Because I think if you, so closing thought on that, I think if you took this conversation, and we should think about how to be deliberate about this, to a cohort of 30-something managers, 30-ish age managers, you get a different reaction than if
Oh, yeah,
you
sure.
shared it with managers 50 and above. So that's my closing thought about that. I took away some hope really from those observations. And Asha was just a great guest.
She was fantastic. Well, with that, I have to say sayonara. So I will see you soon, Jerry, and thank you so much for another great show.
Thank you, Neil. Take care.